From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the 8th day of December, 2022. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Matt Bennett. Jim Wiesemeyer will be here to discuss ag policy. He's from Washington, D.C. and spoke at today's Strategic Farm Marketing webinar here in Champaign County. And as we close out our time together, we'll discuss the weather forecast, too, with Mike Tenor at T-Storm Weather. That's online at tstorm.com.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
March corn for the day at $6.42 and a half, up a penny and a quarter. The May at $6.44 and a quarter, up 1 and a half. And December futures of next year, new crop down a penny and three quarters at $5.94 and a half. January beans, $14.86 and a quarter, up 14 and a quarter. The March at $14.90 and a quarter, up 13. And November beans down one today at $13.97 and three quarters. Bean meal up $7.40. The bean oil 35 cents higher. Wheat futures soft red down 3 and a quarter at $7.46 and a quarter. The hard red at $7.77, down 2 and three quarters. Live cattle futures off 37 and a half cents for the day. The feeders were $2.57 and a half cents higher, and lean hogs were $1.95 lower on the afternoon. Matt Bennett from AgMarket.net now joins us to discuss what happened at the CBO2, the CME Group in Chicago. Hi, Matt. Thanks for being with us. How did things finish up today? Beans were trying to rally.
Yeah, beans ended up having a pretty decent day, especially on the front month. You know, whenever you look, Jan beans, it looks to me like we're going to settle up around 14 and a half to 15 cents. You know, and so that's within about a nickel of the high. Pretty solid day overall for beans. They kind of flailed around there for a while and didn't seem like they wanted to rally too much. And then you looked over and all of a sudden the meal market kind of caught on fire and then, you know, spilled over into the beans as well. Oil was up on the day. Soybean oil was up on the day as well. So it's kind of one of those things that basically boosts the whole deal. You look at Argentine weather, and it's definitely a big concern for the trade. Anytime you see hot and dry weather in Argentina, you're going to see a bean meal rally, which typically spills over into soybeans. And so that's what's going on at the present time. Forecasts have been jumping around a little bit, but we just haven't seen a whole lot of verification of any rainfall, and it's getting kind of concerning for those guys.
Yeah, so they're getting later in the season. It becomes a problem because, just like here in the United States, the later you get, if you haven't got the crop in the ground, acres are go down as well as bushels or tons in this case. How does it reflect in the corn market, if at all?
Corn market's a reluctant follower along with beans. I mean, you've got a couple things going on. You know, the wheat market doesn't seem like it really wants to do much. Kind of settled within the midst of its range, right in the middle, down a penny or two on wheat. Corn was actually up a little on the front month east going into closure here. But, you know, you look, for instance, at March, up a penny. But you look out to D23, and we're actually down a couple. So this D23 all of a sudden is down around 594 and a quarter, whereas we spent a lot of time between 6 and 630, 635. You know, I've got a lot of phone calls right now, people asking, you know, are you getting nervous about 23? And I mean, it's still historically an awfully strong price, but I'm well aware that we've all got a lot of money out there on the table. So corn market was actually kind of boring on the day, but we did have a little bit of a range. You know, we had about 7 cent range, you know, and so we settled about 3 off the highs as far as March corn was concerned, but 4 off the lows. So, you know, the market at least had a little bit of a gain on the day.
Are you nervous about November or December corn of next year?
You know, I think that the whole thing is this. The trade is trying to balance the fact that we've got a pretty tight carry situation that most expect to grow. And so are we going to see any bit of an uptick tomorrow on the WASDE report? Probably not a huge adjustment, but I could certainly see them taking some exports away. That's probably long overdue. I've got to think that we're going to run well behind the original forecast of the USDA. With that being said, it's still going to be an extremely tight carryout. But you're trying to balance that tight situation here in the U.S. with a global situation. It's not as tight, you know, and that the forecast for a big acreage jump for the Safrinha crop could put a big crop on the board again for the second year in a row out of Brazil. So, you know, I think that that's what the trade's trying to balance. I don't think you can kill this corn market just yet. Fundamentally, we're in good shape here in the U.S., but I know markets sure want to move lower. At least it acts like that's a path of least resistance. I just don't think you can quite kill it until you ensure decent acres, because quite frankly, here in the U.S., we're going to need good acres of corn again.
Turn your attention back to soybeans for just a second, but stay with new crop this time around. We've talked about making new crop corn sales to cover input cost. There is a $14 mark out there for soybeans earlier in the day for that November. Should producers consider covering input costs there?
Yeah, you traded up to 14.02 and a quarter today. A lot of folks stepped in and hedged 23 beans today at $14. I know, talking to our friends there at JSA, the sister company there, a lot of hedging going on, more so than what you see on a typical day whenever you get to $14 on the note 23. So, there's definitely people paying attention. To me, Todd, I don't know any producers, quite frankly, that have ever hedged their new crop beans in December the year before were $14. It's just not something that many of us have ever seen, let alone been had the chance to enjoy. So, I don't want to snub my nose at those prices too much. Quite frankly, I think you lock in a pretty decent portion of it. You can always play it from the long side later if you want, but good night, that's a good price. And so, we don't have near as many input costs on soybeans what we do as far as corn's concerned, but $14 beans pays for a lot of those costs, whichever ones we're talking about.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
That's Matt Bennett. He is with agmarket.net. The folks from Strategic Farm Marketing are holding their annual event at the I Hotel throughout the day today and kicked off this morning's program with Jim Wiesemeyer. He's a DTN Pro Farmer and a policy analyst based in Washington, D.C. He's also from the state of Illinois and went to SIU. I asked him to start there for me.
Yes, SIU, Carbondale, and Edwardsville. Primarily Edwardsville. Its first few years, actually, in existence. I went there first in East St. Louis, and then Edwardsville. I loved all my professors at SIU. They were fantastic.
It's good to have you back with us. You've been, of course, at the WILL AM 580 Beef House event, the All Day Ag Outlook. That was several years ago. You're always wonderful to listen to, whether you're doing things for Pro Farmer or your Signal to Noise podcast. I enjoy that thoroughly,
Thank you.
By
Thank
the
you
way.
Very it is much. Thank you very much. And there, it's mostly noise, as you well know, but once in a while you get a clear signal.
Now, speaking of clear signals, one of the things that you talked about very clearly to the crowd that's been gathered here for the Strategic Farm Marketing Crop Insurance Conference today in Champaign is that as it relates to the 2023 Farm Bill, producers, farmers should just simply say whatever the Democrats would like for the food and feeding programs, give it to them. And then ask what you want for.
Yeah, I think. Now, some groups don't like when I say that, but this is my, we've had 19 farm bills throughout the history of our country. This will be my 11th, okay? And you think you've learned something over that 50-year period, and that's one of the things I've learned. Now, I mean, not everything to give on food and nutrition. However, we've seen in the past two farm bills voted down in the House when the Republicans got too wonky on worker requirements. Not that there shouldn't be worker requirements, it's to what degree. Once you get that hurdle done as far as Democrats signing off on food and nutrition funding, which is about 85% of farm bill funding. That's why it's so important. And you don't want to break it away from the farm bill, because then you wouldn't have the suburbanites and urbanites, members. Many may not vote for a farm bill only. So once that happens, then you can turn the focus to how do you improve the Title I farmer safety net and some elements of the crop insurance program, because we've had several years now of ad hoc disaster payments, and that's getting some crop insurance agents and companies a bit nervous, because the more you have ad hoc multi-billion dollar payments, the recent one we've had is a $10 billion program for crops and livestock, and we're going to have another one for eligible 2022 crops and livestock. It raises the moral hazard of some farmers saying, maybe I shouldn't buy tie up as much on crop insurance, because if it's really bad, the government will come out with another WIP Plus or ERP or whatever they're going to call it in the future. And I agree with that. We need to take the reason why we've had to go ad hoc and morph that into improvements for the crop insurance. It won't be dollar for dollar. You'll still have some ad hoc disaster, maybe fires and things like that, forest fires, you know, stuff like that, California and elsewhere. But that's a significant debate that is going to happen. And we saw G.T. Thompson, the incoming House Ag Committee chairman, say that basically earlier this week. He wants improvements in crop insurance, and he wants to deal with that ad hoc disaster.
How do they go about doing it? I think you suggested a way, which was to raise the loan and deficiency payment rates.
Yeah, in the reference prices. And, you know, that's even controversial because, you know, you have two large acreage crops, corn and soybeans. If that may bust the budget bank if you raise the reference prices too high, although other commodities like rice, I'm going down to talk later to the USA Rice Federation, and they're in hurtful times right now, so they haven't had the upward thrust in prices that, say, corn and soybeans have. So, but there are areas to improve the farmer safety net. And as I mentioned, some of the best farm bills I've covered as a reporter in my reporting days was when the ag committees asked the commodity groups, okay, what do you want? You know, how much do you think it's going to cost? They don't ask them how to find the money. That's the role of Congress. And I think that if they would do that, I always like when it's grassroots because, you know, farmers, they know what I think what is needed for a better backstop. And you really need farm programs when prices are low to very low, not when they're high.
In the last farm bill, and I don't know what your opinion is on this exactly, but there seemed to be a movement of dollars funding from the Northwest to the Southeast. Senator Hovind may have something to say about that in this farm bill. Of course, he's from North Dakota.
Yeah.
And then G.T. Walker's from Pennsylvania and from Michigan on the Senate side is Debbie Stabenow.
Yeah. Who leads the committee, especially in agriculture? It is bipartisan. It's still bipartisan, but definitely it helps. And what I've seen over the years, if the southern states are not adequately represented in the farm bill, those farm state lawmakers from the south, although very polite in public, know how to fight. So, you know, I'm in Illinois, and I know the soil, the black earth that you measure in feet. When you go outside of this great state, you measure a black earth in inches in a number of states. And that means a different type of a policy because a lot of times they don't have a tight basis. They're not in the river markets like Illinois and Iowa is. So that calls for a fair approach. That doesn't mean that corn and soybean states shouldn't have a big say because that's where most of the production is. But you have to have a balance there because there's different reasons for the fundamentals of agriculture in different states.
You also mentioned in your discussion here at this strategic farm marketing event that trade will play a big role over the next couple of years, and you have some concerns.
Yeah, my concern is that we've got too many eggs in China's basket, and we have two or three China watchers that we consult with at ProFarmer, and they are all saying within 5 years. China's going to deal with Taiwan. And so if that's the case, we have to increase the number of our market access opportunities outside China. And it can be done, but you have to start announcing some of these new trade agreements, whether it's administratively. There's some things they can do without Congress, or through, like we said before, with the United Kingdom. The U.K., is almost begging us to have a trade agreement with them. We should do it because we can sell a lot of U.S. feed to the livestock producers in the U.K., and then that would give the signal to other European countries that, hey, their livestock producers can get a more competitively priced feed grain for their livestock industry. So for that and other reasons, we need to start on that path of going back to typical trade agreements of the past. The Biden administration has taken a different approach. I understand that. But this China black swan is hanging over us. And now's the time to act on new trade agreements. It's called market access.
How important is fast-track authority in this?
If you have a bona fide trade agreement that needs the Senate's approval, it is very important because under fast-track or trade promotion authority, TPA, you bring a new trade agreement up for a vote without any amendments. That's why it's fast-track, and that's needed. It has expired now, so I would say if your audience hears that the White House has requested a renewal of TPA or fast-track authority, that's a good sign. That means that they have one or a number of new trade agreements that they want Congress to approve.
The U.S. Trade Representative is Catherine Tai. How does she differ, if very much?
Yeah, she's very much a technocrat. She wrote a lot of the regulatory language for the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. So she knows her stuff. She knows the ins and outs of trade enforcement, et cetera. But she's not the politician that we usually see in that USTR post. The Trump administration had Bob Lighthizer. He took no enemies. He was tough. She's taken a different approach. And I just think that it has to change because we're not seeing much progress in the trade policy arena in the first 2 years under the Biden administration. But now I think I see the beginning of the pivot to look for other areas, and the trade policy is one area. But, you know, the downside, to show you the lack of priority, there's two trade officials, one at the U.S. Trade Rep's office and the other one at USDA, that have still not been approved in Congress. And now they may go until the next Congress before they approve it. I think that they will eventually, if they extend the lame duck session of Congress, which they probably will. But that tells you a lot right there. These two very important positions, the trade undersecretary post at USDA and then the ag trade spot at the U.S. trade rep's office. I mean, and they're not even approved because of lawmaker holds on, you know, both of those positions. But it's important to have someone leading the charge at both USTR and USDA.
Jim, thank you for taking the time with me today.
Anytime.
Jim Wiesemeyer is with Pro Farmer, and you can find his podcast online. Just search out Signal to Noise.
Mike Tenura is now here. He's with T-Storm Weather at tstorm.net online to talk about the agricultural weather forecast. Hi, Mike. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Todd. Great being here. Thanks for having me.
Let's begin in South America. Argentina remains in trouble and looks like things are not going to get better as it relates to dry weather conditions.
Yeah, they're going to see some storms over the next few days in Argentina, and that will help a little bit. But they need a lot of rain to get out of this situation. The last 7 months were the driest on record in more than 44 years across key regions. And the rain that's coming up is not going to change that situation. If we give Argentina about an inch to an inch and a half of rain over the next 2 weeks, we'll still end up having the driest period on record going all the way back to May 1st. And those records started in 1979. So, Todd, it's going to take a lot to get out of this situation. We know that corn and soybean planting are pretty far behind schedule because of the lack of rain. And even though there is some on the way, the story probably is not going to change a whole lot, at least over the next couple of weeks.
So as we know, it is written once we get far enough into planting that yields, no matter what happens the rest of the time, will be lower. That's the case for Argentina. What about for Paraguay and southern Brazil?
Well, they haven't been as nearly as dry as Argentina, and they are pretty nearby, just going to the immediate north of Argentina. The potential issue there is that there's not a whole lot of rain coming up. Yes, there is some, and they'll continue to have more rain. But over the next couple of weeks, around 2.5 inches of rain is normal of the areas that border Argentina. And if you go a little bit further north into the key areas of Paraná and then into northern Paraguay, they average about 3.5 inches of rain over the next 2 weeks. It looks like we're going to see about 40% to 80% of normal over this period of time. And while that might not be a wipeout by any means, it's not totally dry, it's not enough given that it has been a little bit dry just over the last couple of weeks as well. So this drought appears to be expanding a little bit into parts of Brazil, and that's the next thing to monitor as we move forward.
Yeah, here in the United States, we've had dry weather conditions in the Southwest. Will those persist, and are we concerned about other things that might be happening in the near term as it relates to winter months?
Well, it's going to be very stormy over the next week. We have a powerhouse system that's going to move through early next week. That will move directly across Kansas and Oklahoma, but you never want a storm system to move directly overhead because typically that's not where most of the precipitation forms. Most of it forms ahead of the system and then to the north. And it looks at this point like we're not going to see a whole lot of rain in these driest areas. We will see some, but not enough to alleviate the drought. But the thing that we're monitoring is what's going to happen up to the north. It looks like we're going to unleash a fairly significant blizzard across the Dakotas and maybe including much of Minnesota early next week. That would start on Monday and then end Tuesday or Wednesday with 10 to 20 inches of wind-driven snow. So we'll see how all that pans out because that's enough snow across flatlands to significantly disrupt rail and air service and roadway service across that region. So it's something to watch, especially for people who are moving crops around or who are dealing with feedlots. But that's kind of the main issue for the U.S. The beneficial part of that storm is that it's going to produce a lot of rain. We'll see some rain here and there over the next few days, but then a fairly significant event from Monday through Wednesday across the Corn Belt and Mid-South. That should improve these river levels, which are still very low after the dryness that we've seen. The only caveat is that as we increase these river levels, it's going to turn a lot colder after the system moves through. So a week from now and even 10 days from now, temperatures will be quite a bit below normal, and we think these rivers will be freezing in at least the western growing areas of the Corn Belt and into the plains.
How much rainfall are you expecting in the Mid-South, for instance, or even in Illinois and Indiana?
Well, for most of the Corn Belt, we expect about 1 to 2 inches of rain, and that's a lot for this time of the year. If you isolate out central Illinois and plot out how much rain is expected to happen, it would actually end up being one of the wetter two-week periods for this time of the year, going back over the last 20 or 30 years. That's only a two-week period, though, so over the longer historical period, it's not all that unusual. But it just gives you an idea that the amount of rain that's coming up is significant for December, and we normally don't see this type of a rain event at this time of the year. Totals will be even higher off to the south and the mid-south, where we're thinking 1.5 to 3.5 inches of rain is a pretty good probability over the next week. And that's also very wet for them for this time of the year. Also, again, giving you one of the wetter 15-day periods in the middle of January going back 30 or 40 years. So it's a lot of rain coming up in a short period of time. After it moves through, things dry out for a little bit. But with that colder weather pattern, that typically shifts the jet stream further to the south, and that leads to better snow chances with time. So that'll be something to watch for that last 10 days of December. But between now and then, most of all snow will be limited to far northern areas, with it just a little bit too warm initially for much more than rain across the rest of the Corn Belt and Mid-South.
Thank you very much.
Yep, great being here, Todd.
We'll talk with you again next week. That's Mike Tenere. He's at T-Storm Weather. Find him online at tstorm.net. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report. It came to you from Illinois Public Media.